I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. I thought it would be appropriate with the 2014 Olympics coming, Winter Olympics coming up here, that we talk about Sochi, Russia, and Russia in general, and what's happening in that area. Now, I was interested to find out that where they're holding the Olympics is actually a subtropical climate, but I guess they do get snow up in the mountains there. They're just on the edge of the Caucasus. They're a few miles north of Georgia, but one of the most interesting things I found out about the area was that it used to be predominantly Muslim, and then in the late 19th century, they were forced out, and now it is primarily Russians, and it's a Greek Orthodox like that in that area. But the thing is, what is happening in that area? There's been some bombings, Jim. Is there still a lot of potential problems for the Olympics this year?
Russia was expanding through most of the 18th and 19th century, expanding east and south. It was a very important period in their history, which you don't hear much about outside of Russia, but it was a big deal because they expanded farther than, say, the United States did in the 18th and 19th century. We went west. They went east. We actually met in Alaska. Russians encountered all sorts of interesting people. Many of them had previously sent people to invade Russia, which is one reason for the expansion. The Russians were among the few European people who were actually conquered and ruled by the Mongols. And they've never forgotten that. Again, that's something that most in the West are totally unaware of. But it's a central part of Russian culture and thinking, and how they put together their military policy. They are very nervous about being invaded. It wasn't just the Mongols. There's basically no natural barriers to invasion. And Russians have always been surrounded by a lot of ambitious, nasty, not always successful people. And there's always been a lot of fighting. So it wasn't just the French and the Germans, but the big invasion, the one that actually took, was the Mongols. After that, they had problems with the Turks for centuries. They managed to resist the Turks, which, again, is a big deal in Russia. It's also a big deal in Turkey, but that's another story. Push into the Caucasus was basically an attempt to plug one of the highways of invaders, coming up from the south. You go through the Caucasus. And when they did that, they encountered a fair bit of resistance, and they dealt with it in ways that are now considered, unacceptable. They were pretty brutal. And, ethnic cleansing in Sochi and many other places was, simply part of the solution. In fact, in World War II, the Chechens, who were among the most, unruly people in the Caucasus that they encountered, were at the time the Germans were, battling over Stalingrad, now Volgograd. Stalin was pretty certain that the Chechens could not be relied on if Germans got close. Stalin was born and raised in Georgia. He was an ethnic Georgian, so he might have had a little, ethnic, fear, as it were, because the Georgians never cared too much for the Chechens, who are their neighbors. So he had the entire Chechen population moved to Central Asia. About half of them died in the process, which was fairly typical of Stalin's, operations like that. And they weren't allowed back into the 1950s. Again, this is a big deal with Chechens. It's still a big deal with the Russians. The problem is that, and this is the central problem with Russia and the Caucasus, not so much Russia and the Muslims, but Russia and just the Caucasus, which is primarily but not entirely Muslim. The Chechens are extremely resistant to outside rule. They are also extremely resistant to law and order, even among themselves. And this could most clearly be seen in the 1990s, right after the Soviet Union collapsed. Chechnya wanted to be declared independent, as, you know, 14 other parts of the old Soviet Union were. I mean, the Soviet Union lost about, you know, half its population as it released, you know, Ukraine, Central Asia, Belarus, etc., and the Baltic states. The Russians said no to Chechnya, partly because they didn't trust the Chechens. That's something they learned the hard way in the 18th and 19th century. Partly because they had an oil pipeline going through Chechnya, and they didn't trust the Chechens to leave that alone. So they said no. The Chechens said, screw you, and they rebelled. They actually became independent. Now, this was bizarre, but by Russian standards, it wasn't all that unusual. The Russians pulled out after some nasty, fighting, where the Russians found out that their Soviet-era military was worse than the Americans were describing it as being. And they said, all right, here's what we'll do. And this is all unofficial. They said, we will pull our forces and a lot of our ethnic Russians out of Chechnya. We will continue to pay pensions and other social benefits to people in Chechnya, and we will basically leave you alone if you will leave us alone. Now, most Chechens, and the place was being run by clans, well, it was always influenced by clans, but the clan leaders said, yeah, okay, we can make that work. But instead, Chechnya became, gangster central for that region. Chechens and some of the other thugs in the region realized that they could kidnap Russians in southern Russia, get them into Chechnya, where the Russians wouldn't come, and get negotiate a ransom. And this became a big deal. On top of that, the great resurgence of Islamic radicalism was underway. This was, you know, in the wake of the Russian withdrawal from Afghanistan in 1988, which was mainly because of the Cold War and the Russian economy, ending at the same time, and not because the Russians were beaten. They just said, this isn't worth it. The ethnic Chechens, who were never particularly religious, they were nominally Muslim, a number of them had fought in Afghanistan because it was the thing to do if you were young and crazy and somewhat religious. And they come back and said, look, let's turn this whole Caucasus into a Islamic Republic, religious dictatorship, run, of course, by Chechens. And a lot of Chechens said, that sounds like a great idea. So you had the gangsters who were basically rampaging all throughout southern Russia. And then you had the Islamic radicals who were beginning to basically branch out into other parts of the Caucasus and trying to convert the other Muslims in the region, who were never into Islamic conservatism or Islamic fundamentalism, but saying, hey, look, let's be done with all these damn Slavs, these Russians, and we have a new deal. Putin came into power that late 90s, and he said, no, that's not going to happen. And he basically went old school on the Chechens. He gathered together an army of troops, Russian troops who were reliable. The Russian military had learned from their humiliation in the early 90s and sort of gotten their act together. They, basically identified the units like the airborne and certain, paramilitary units that recruited good people and trained them well that could be relied upon in combat. And they went back in and they basically reconquered, Chechnya. A low-level war has been going on ever since, even though the Russians, since 2000, after a few years, they basically got the clan leaders together and said, look, here's the deal. We are not leaving, but you can have our backing and be the kingpins in Chechnya if you will basically, keep things reasonably quiet. This is what the ancient Romans used to tell their, the provincial governors. You can steal as much as you can as long as you keep things quiet. And this is basically what's been going on in Chechnya. The favor of the pro-Russian clans have been given all the guns and ammunition they want, and basically permission to steal within limits whatever they can get away with. They basically, in addition to Russian special forces who are still down there, continue to fight the remaining Islamic radicals. Most of them have since left Chechnya and moved next door to Dagestan and, you know, a few and other areas in the Russian Caucasus, and causing mischief there. But basically, the Islamic violence has come way down, but it's still there. And it will probably not go away for another 10 or 20 years, because Islamic radicalism, which tends to reoccur every generation or so and has been doing this for centuries, doesn't go away until a younger generation realizes that it's not working and they no longer, you know, volunteer. And the Russians are aware of that. And that's basically what they're doing. You know, as far as they're concerned, Islamic radicalism is a nuisance. They've been dealing with it for hundreds of years. They know how to cope with it. And they're just doing what they've always been doing. They don't give a damn what the rest of the world thinks. That's where it stands right now. Putin really thinks that he can keep the Islamic terrorists out of Sochi. Apparently, he has a good chance of doing that. He has nearly 40,000 additional soldiers and police in the area. The Russians have shown in the last decade that when they put their minds to it and don't get lazy and sloppy, which they tend to do after a while, well, so does the United States, they can basically, you know, lock the terrorists out of an area, a large area, most of Russia, for example. There are still some terrorist attacks, a number of attacks that would not be tolerated in the United States. But then again, we don't live with a Chechens, you know, within the country. I mean, parts of New Mexico were occupied and had been occupied for over a couple thousand years by Chechens. We might be singing a different tune, but we're not. And so, you know, we and the Europeans can criticize the Russians a lot. But again, if you look at it from the Russian point of view, which is important, it looks quite different. And, you know, the Russian methods, as it were, make more sense. They're not any more acceptable to most Westerners. But, you know, we don't all live in Russia. And so we can say whatever the hell we want.
All right. Austin, what's your view on how things are going to go and what's happening there currently?
Well, let me pick up on Jim's point about Russian interest in the Caucasus. Leo Tolstoy's collection of short stories from the mid-19th century, and it's some of his best writing. I'm not just my opinion, in his own opinion, and one of usually the title for the collection is Prisoner in the Caucasus, and it's about a Russian czarist army officer who's imprisoned by, well, Jim refers to them as the Tatars in the book, but they're Muslim people. They're Chechens, actually, Dagestanis that the armies in. Tolstoy actually served in the in the Caucasus, and it's some of this associated too with what's going on in the 1850s. Remember the Crimean War is as well. But Jim talks about the Russian fear of invasion. At the same time, you look at Tsar Peter the Great. You know, his answer for dealing with the invasion, as Jim said, let's take terrain that's a blocking position. And he would take a blocking position or an expansion to try to get a seaport or get an outlet to the Black Sea or the Caspian, or in St. Petersburg's an outlet to the Baltic Sea. Remember that. And, of course, then it would be a next base for an expansion. So if you're going to look at it from the Russians' perspective, also look at it from the Caucasian tribes perspective. One other thing too, and Jim talks about this as Muslim Muslim lands. Look, it's mountains. You got a little bit of everything there. Armenia makes the case, and it's in the Caucasus, that it's one of the oldest Christian kingdoms. And, they're right. There's some debate about the years that Armenia was Christianized, whether the first missionaries were entering in the second, third, fourth century or the like, but they're there. And Dan, the Orthodox, it's Russian Orthodox for the most part, even though you do have a legacy along the Eastern Black Sea coast, because they were pagan Greek trading colonies, but then they became a Greek Orthodox as well. Now, how do I think this is going to play out? Take a look at some of the things we've had up on Strategy Page and some of the more recent wire service reports. The Islamist militants see this as a perfect opportunity to get what terrorists always want: huge headlines, scary headlines, in about an event that cannot be ignored. Boston Marathon, same kind of huge public event. This is the Boston Marathon on steroids. It's the Olympics, and it's also a punch at Vladimir Putin in a major way, because Putin. Jim, correct me on this if I've got the date wrong. It was 99 or 2000 that he said that the terrorist threat, he was resolving the terrorist threat presented by the Chechens and Dagestanis, and he used that threat to solidify his own power. And even though he had interim president, he's used his war with the war. It's not just his war, but the war with Islamist militants as a means of solidifying and justifying his own personal power in Russia. And the militants have taken the opportunity to say, "Hey, Vladimir, we're still here." So I know Jim's talking about the brutal methods that you can't use anymore. I don't know that the Russians don't use them, Jim. I think they do. So.
Oh, they do. I'm saying that. I'm saying they just wouldn't be acceptable on these. And yes, you're right. Putin did use the threat of his Chechen and Islamic terrorism to basically reimpose what is basically a neo, you know, communist or police state. But at the same time, while some of those terrorist attacks may have been staged by the secret police, there's no definitive proof yet. A lot of them were most definitely Islamic terrorists.
So probably with the techniques that the Russians are using like that, the greatest fear that the Olympics has this year is not having enough snow, probably.
Yeah, Sochi, while in a semi-tropical area, or tropical by Russian standards, the mountains, as happens like in the East Coast, occasionally on the West Coast, when you have a dry year, you got no snow, or you have heat waves, you know, which occasionally happen. So that's a chance that the Olympic Committee decided they were willing to take. Who knows? Bribes were involved. That's a whole other story.
Right. Well, I guess I saw a report that they'd actually stored up snow and manufactured snow last year and covered it with some sort of insulation material, and that they've got that ready in case they've got problems. It's sort of like some of, like you said, some of the East Coast areas and some of the areas over on our West Coast that sometimes do have snow and don't have snow. What other areas are having issues in Russia at this time? What other problems are they facing, Jim?
Well, the biggest problems are not so much regional, but political and economic. Corruption is their single biggest problem. The Russians have always had a problem with corruption. It goes back to the time of the Tsars, and the communists said they were going to get rid of it. That was always part of the communist, you know, promises. And they did sort of clean things up for a while. But by the 1930s, you know, then, of course, you have World War II. These were all times of less corruption by Russian standards. So from the Russian point of view, the first couple of decades of communist rule were relatively corruption-free, or there was a lot less corruption by traditional standards. You know, Grandpa would say in the 1920s and 30s, oh, my God, you know, people are so much more honest. But after World War II, by the 1960s, corruption was back to czarist levels, and it actually started getting worse. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the arrangements, the, how should I put it, the formal, the organized corruption, which often isn't seen as corruption, disappeared, and all the corruption became blatant. It was basically a madhouse. Every corrupt official for themselves. And the corruption has become the major problem in Russia. It's so bad that, I mean, it doesn't just make life miserable for Russians, which it has definitely done to the point where even Putin, and it, you know, who basically does pay attention to the opinion polls and what the people think. He doesn't always do what they want, but he pays attention to what they think. He has made some serious efforts to address the corruption problem, but it is so bad at all levels, especially at the highest levels, that a lot of foreign companies will not invest anymore. You know, the problem is twofold economically. One, Russians who make money have a tendency to send it out of the country, often illegally. There are limits on how much Russian capital you can export, and there's a thriving and corrupt industry which will get the money out of the country for you. And international banking systems in the last few decades have become much more capable of detecting patterns of illegal funds flows, as we call it in the financial community. And so you can actually measure it with a great degree of accuracy. I mean, the people running Russia can only gnash their teeth because this stuff is slipping through their fingers and they just can't, you know, get their hands around this money that is going out of the country. But at the same time, many countries who were willing and eager to invest in Russia in the 1990s and until about 10 years ago are now backing off. And they're telling Putin point blank. And a lot of these people get to sit down with Putin and his senior officials and they tell him, we're not investing any money. And they give him a long list of outrages that they've suffered where literally Russian officials have stolen their money, have taken away their investments. I mean, let's not put a pretty face on it. It was outright theft, and it was oftentimes pretty blatant. And even Putin, you know, caught this really quick, and he's been trying to crack down on it, but it's become out of control, and it's a bigger problem than Islamic terrorism. So when Austin was saying, you know, Putin was using Islamic terrorism, you know, to basically divert people's attention, that's very true. And what he was diverting attention from was not just reimposing a police state, which a lot of Russians go along with. They approve of that as long as they think it will somehow get rid of the corruption, which to a certain extent it has. But by centralizing government, by reestablishing basically a police state, by Russian standards, that makes it easier for the corrupt people to operate. So Putin has a no-win situation. He's very much an old school guy. I mean, he came up, you know, as a KGB man. He thinks that centralized control can still work. He doesn't think communism can work, but he thinks that a strong central dictatorship, as it were, can work. But he hasn't been able to make it happen yet. And so it's corruption that more than anything else is causing the problems. And, you know, the Sochi and Islamic terrorism is literally a sideshow.
Austin, do you want to add anything before we wrap this up on the short one we're doing today?
Yeah, I think Jim's expansion on my point about Putin is dead on. Corruption is the issue. I would add that Putin has his own corrupt clique. Now, how corrupt it is compared to the former nomenclatura, I think less. Is it... what's a good standard of comparison? I'm really at a loss to find a direct analogy because, as Jim points out, there are places within Russia where it's a lot better even under Putin than it was certainly under the collapsing Soviet dictatorship. There's also more information. Porosity. I mean, free flow of information in Russia, and Putin, to some degree, doesn't try to stop it. He certainly tries to stop criticism of him and his his ruling clique, but he's not very successful at it. But if I said, Dan, that it was somewhat similar to Iron Gang taking over a Caribbean island, whether I get my old pals, I think that's probably as close to it, even though Russia is certainly no Caribbean island. It's he's got Putin and his clique have corruption issues as well. You don't want to have Russia's problems and to see major media consider Putin as man of the year because of quote unquote his foreign policy successes. They're the foreign policy successes of perception. If Syria is your victory, you know, because of frustrating the United States, you haven't done much, really.
Right. Well, it'll be interesting to watch the next few weeks and see how things play out, and then the rest of the year as things continue to percolate in Russia and they continue to struggle with their issues, just as we struggle here in the U.S. with our issues. We'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Bye, Dan.
Bye.
Indeed. Till then.